This is Peter Higgins at Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Phil Oakley. Phil Oakley is a professional share analyst at ShareScope, and they have the software package ShareePad, which is has been voted the UK's best investment software in 2015. Now, Phil has a vast experience of working in the city, having worked there for over 13 years, and is now decided to pursue a career of training and educating investors. Hello, Phil, and how are you today?
Hello, Peter. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. It's an absolute joy to have you on here, mate. I've really been quite keen to catch up with you because you have been popping up everywhere regarding ShareScope and ShearePad, and the software has been endorsed by so many different people that I wanted to get you on here to speak about your journey and also ShareScope and the software that you use.
Okay. Happy to do that.
Excellent. Now, Phil, I wanted to, because there's still a few people out there that don't know about Phil Oakley, and invariably they think of Human League, and I'm sure you've heard that joke many times.
Oh, yeah. I'd have a pound for that. I'd be rich.
So I wanted you to just give us a little bit of an intro as to who this Phil Oakley is and who you are and your career background and initial interest in investing, please, mate.
Okay, yeah, fine. Well, actually, I like the Human League lead singer, I am from Sheffield as well.
Oh, how uncanny is that?
He lived about 3 miles away from where I grew up.
Is there a family connection? Is there a blood lineage there somewhere?
No. There's the letter L. He's Oakey. I am Oakley.
Right, okie dokie. There you go, my so, error.
So, yeah. Background, I suppose. I've always thought, you know, if you'd asked me, you know, 25, 30 years ago when I was at school or university, I would have never sort of envisaged the career that I've had. If you said to me, would I want to be an analyst or a stockbroker and work in the city, I'd have probably said no. But my interest and my sort of career path sort of developed from being a student of economics. I did a couple of degrees in economics, and economics was one of the sort of subjects at school that really sort of grabbed me. Yeah. In that it sort of related to the real world in some respects. And it sort of followed from that. And as you study economics more and more, you realize it gets more and more away from the real world. But in its basic form, it does bear some resemblance. And, you know, through studying things like accountancy and finance on my courses, and also having a love of numbers, really.
Yeah.
I sort of fell into it. You know, you look at, you finish your degree and you're looking for a job to do, and you see an advert for a job, and you think, I can do that. And that was, yeah. I started off working for a very small regional wealth manager in Liverpool, taken on as a trainee analyst. And that was actually, even now I look back and think, that's actually shaped me and the way I think and what I think about investing to this day. And it was a fantastic education. We were paid absolute peanuts, but the wealth that we acquired in terms of knowledge and how to learn about investing and analyzing was just absolutely brilliant. And I spent a lot of time following probably 7 or 8 sectors, just immersing yourself in it and talking to fund managers within the firm. I did that for about 2.5 years, and then I had a carrot dangled in front of me by a stockbroker who wanted me to come and be a transport analyst, working partly in Liverpool, partly in London, because that's where the firm was based. And being a sort of young guy who needed to earn a bit more money, I said yes. And that sent me down the path of probably 8 years working for a couple of different stockbroking firms as an investment analyst. Basically writing research reports and passing on your advice and your findings to fund managers. And the experience is actually a real privilege in lots of ways. The education that you get, the access to company management, and just the whole process of learning about how the world of money works is, you know, quite an eye opener. And but actually, what I realised is that I actually didn't really enjoy it. Whilst I enjoyed writing research and learning stuff, I think my temperament wasn't right for it. I think I was too kind of focused on finding bad things rather than finding good things. And I think one of the things I've learned as I've got older is to be a bit more optimistic and look at the other side of the coin. And I think after about 7 or 8 years, I got fed up of it, and I decided to go and work for quite a big fund manager. And I actually found that quite disappointing, quite frustrating as well, in that you realize that, you know, what you learn about investing, you know, from a theory side and from a practicing researching side, when you actually try and put that into practice in proper investing,
yeah,
the two actually don't match up. Okay. And I just, you know, you put under so many constraints about what you can earn, and if you buy a share that doesn't do very well, then people start worrying that customers are going to take their money out and you'll have less money to manage and less fees. And it, you know, you throw in that with the lifestyle, and okay, it's a good, well paid job, but one that, you know, I realized eventually I had to stop doing.
Yeah.
And this was about, what, 2009. And I've always been very lucky that I have a very, very understanding and talented wife who also is, you know, she's a doctor, so we've always had a little bit of security from her job. And I sort of gave up working in the city, and I actually looked after my children for a couple of years and really enjoyed that. But then there sort of comes a time when you think, what am I going to do with my life? And you spend a lot of time thinking, you know, what can I do? What do I have? And what I realized what I did like was I liked writing. I liked finding out about things, and I liked explaining them to people. And that was one of the good things about my job in the city, is I actually wrote a lot of research reports, and I loved doing it. And I loved gaining the understanding. So I looked at how I could actually employ that skill set in a different way. And that's what led me to going to write for Money Week.
Yeah.
And that was really educational as well, because what I realized when I started working for Money Week, and I worked for an extremely good editor there, and you realize that how you write as a professional is complete nonsense to the man or the woman in the street. You, like every profession, you end up getting stuck into a kind of jargon that nobody really understands.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you learn to write in plain English. And that was a real, real benefit for me there. And I enjoyed quite a large part of the stuff that I did there. And then about a couple of years ago, I think I wrote an article on stock screening, you know, how to filter the stock market. And I got an email from a guy called Tim Clark, who was the general manager of ShareScope. And I suppose sort of spent like 4 or 5 months answering emails, and he was asking me questions about tapping into my analytical background. And eventually he offered me a job. And, you know, what they wanted was somebody with a bit of investment background to help them develop their product, but also to write educational pieces so that people could get the most out of the software. And there's obviously a lot of things going on at ShareScope with a new product, SharePad.
Yeah, yeah.
It suited both of us.
Yeah.
For me, it was great because it actually combines my sort of analytical, my love of analyzing things and building things and developing the product, but also love of writing as well. So far, so good. And that's a sort of rambling view of how I've got to where I am.
No, I really appreciate it. There's a few questions I've got within the bit that you've shared so far, but clearly, having seen the success of ShareePad, it's been a really good marriage of your skills and the backbone and infrastructure that's put together for ShareScope.
I mean, one of the things, you know, about ShareScope and ShearePad is just the stuff that the customer never sees. You know, we've got, it's just the amount of effort it actually takes to get the product that you look at on your computer screen. It's amazing.
Yeah, it does take a while. I mean, we're only on a very small scale putting things together for the LSE Share Talk website, and our techies, as we call them, our CTO is busy all the time, and the simplest of bits of code is writing, and I'm going, I don't really understand that, and then I go, Pete, this is what it does. I'm going, right, okay, I've got that now, but he's been writing it. You know what I mean? Writing that piece of code. Amazing.
You know, I can have an idea of something that wants to go in the software.
Yeah.
And you think, okay. And then you sort of, it takes you a while to realize that that's hours and maybe even of, you know, weeks, months of programming.
Indeed. Indeed.
So, yeah, it's, but it's good. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah. I wanted to go back a little bit, in part to some of your conversation that you had where you said that, You did the stockbroking bit as a transport analyst between Liverpool and London, and then over those 8 years, you spent with different firms writing research report for fund managers. Yeah? And you got to a stage where you're like, you know what, I've got a focus here, and I'm looking at the bad things regarding companies rather than the good. I need to be doing something different. And it's almost a little bit of, I'm sensing a bit of cognitive dissonance there, because instead of getting out, you then went to an even larger firm, going to a fund manager.
Yeah.
Am I right? Have I picked that up right?
Oh, yeah. It's.
So what happened there? Was it a case of, you know, you had to continue with it because you were in that industry, and it was a case of, I'm not sure what else I could do sort of thing?
I think there's an element of that, definitely.
Yeah.
And if I look back now, I think it was a mistake.
Right.
But having said that, my focus has always been about investing. You know, one of the things that I've done ever since I got into it, you know, nearly 20 years ago, is that I've read loads and loads of books.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just spend my daily commute with my, you know, head in a book and reading stuff. And that's how I, you know, taught myself a lot of new skills.
Excellent.
And going to work for a fund manager actually would have given me a chance to do that in a professional way. You know, eventually maybe even become a fund manager. And I think, but what I realized, and I think what sort of finally was the final nail in the coffin for me, is that you realize that, you know, the fund managers themselves are great people. There's some really bright people and, you know, very honorable, a lot of integrity there. The problem is the companies that they work for. The business model of a fund manager is all about, I suppose I've heard it described, the best way I've heard it described is they are asset gatherers. So the more money they have to manage, you multiply that by a little percentage fee and it adds up to a lot of money.
Of course, yeah.
So what happens is that it is of the first and most important thing for the fund management company is to make sure that pot of money stays as big as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that you can keep that pot as big as possible is don't underperform the stock market,
mm-hmm.
which means as a fund manager and an analyst working for a team of fund managers, it can be quite hard to actually differentiate your portfolio from the underlying market or index. Because if you take a big bet against something and it goes wrong, then you look bad. And then you get unit trust salesmen thinking, oh, we know we can't cope with this for much longer. We'll have our customers pulling our money out here.
Yeah.
And it gets a bit stressful. But for me, if you're not going to try and be different from the market, then you really shouldn't be even doing the job.
Agreed,
And I came to the conclusion that I was banging my head against a brick wall. And I think for the sake of my own sanity and and sort of long term health, I just had to try. I just had to get out.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in mindfulness and looking after yourself and, you know, positivity. And there's not a lot of that sometimes on Twitter or in the city or when you're speaking with people regarding stocks and shares. You're either winning or losing. You're either, you know, in vogue because you're telling people good and giving people good advice, or you're out on your ear. You know what I mean? It's very fickle.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's the thing is though, you can't be right all the time.
No one can. Not even Buffet. You know. So that's what that's the way I see it anyway. Now, we've covered your background a little bit there. I wanted to ask, really, you've touched on it already, about 20 years that you've been investing or trading in stocks, and you came around it in a convoluted way, even though you were doing economics. Do you remember the very first stock or investment that you made, Phil?
I do.
Go for it.
And this was a company called Bass, a brewing company.
Yeah, I remember the name. Yeah,
which is now morphed into Intercontinental Hotels.
Yep.
And
after a few other takeovers, yeah.
Yeah, you know, bits of Mitchells and Butler.
Yeah, that's the one.
Out of it, and Britvic, I think, they even owned bits of Britvic.
Yeah, they got spun off. Yeah.
And yeah, that was the first share that I bought because that was the first sector that I ever analysed as an analyst. And that was one of the shares that I actually knew really well, but it actually turned out to be quite a bad investment for me.
Okay, so what year was that you first made that purchase?
I guess that was probably about 1998.
Right,
so 18 years ago.
Excellent. So when you say you did your research, what was your research like at that time?
Well, I thought I knew it. Basically. Because I, you know, I've been following it for probably 18 months, and I've done quite a lot of reviews. I've, you know, spent hours and hours going through the accounts and keeping up with what was going on.
Yeah.
But actually, the lesson that you learn by actually doing proper investing is that you only really get to know a share when you actually own it.
Indeed. Yeah.
You know, it's all very well sort of looking at a company from the outside, but actually there's nothing that focuses your mind when you've got real money on the table,
yeah.
And that investment, I think I basically broke even on it after about 18 months, and I think, looking back, I know why. I'd realised that what had made the company back good in the past, by actually doing a major acquisition, they changed the company's whole financial dynamics. And I sort of failed to realize that. And you know, it's like I think one of the things about investing is that you learn so much from your mistakes.
Yeah, well, your mistakes become the experience that gives you the journey, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, and I think, you know, that's another, I think, valuable lesson. I think the more you do this, I think the better investor you're likely to be.
I absolutely agree with that, definitely. Now, you started with Bass. It didn't work out so well. So that was 1998.
Yeah.
And you as we all do when we first start, when we think we've read a couple of books, we're read up. You know, I mean, you had your economics background, so you had a bit more of an edge to us, ordinary folk. But then it didn't go so well. What was your style then? You did a fair bit of research, and it still went wrong.
Yeah, I think my style is very much. I don't like the term, but I suppose what people would understand as value investing.
Right. Okay. That was.
I don't really like the term because, you know, all investing is value investing. We're all trying to buy stuff that we think's worth more.
Than yes.
Paying.
Yeah.
We just go about it in different ways, and I think for a lot of the early part of my investing career, I actually didn't actually do that well. Because I ended up buying stuff that was cheap, but that was cheap for a reason.
Yeah.
So, you know, you realise that it's like, I always use the analogy with things like bottles of wine. You know, you go into the supermarket and you might see a bottle of wine for £5, and occasionally you'll get lucky, and quite often though you'll be pouring it down the sink.
Yeah, you'd be disappointed,
because,
yeah.
Because you can't drink it. And I think shares are very similar. I think one of the things it took me a long time to realise is that successful investing is about buying good companies. But what you've got to realise when you're buying good companies is that you're not going to buy them at £5 a bottle. You are going to have to pay a little bit more than that.
You're going to have to pay for quality, yeah.
Absolutely. And then it becomes about trying to work out how much is too much. So, you know, my investing philosophy changed a lot, and probably not until that, so maybe sort of 3 or 4 years ago, really. The other thing I think it's important to say is that for a long period of time while I was working in the city, we weren't allowed to own individual shares, particularly of shares that we weren't allowed to own shares in the industries or companies that we covered.
Which is understandable. And
generally, I didn't own a lot of shares in general.
Okay.
I actually spent a lot of time doing like asset class investing.
Right. Okay.
So I one of the other things that I sort of learned is not just to trade shares, but also to look at, you know, various asset classes like precious metals. One of my best investments was buying index linked gilts, probably sort of 2007, and holding them for quite a long time.
Well, that's perfect timing there, wasn't it? Crank
yeah, and bonds as well. You know, in a financial crash, you know, I was able to buy a lot of individual corporate bonds at some really good valuations as well. So, whilst I, you know, it's not to me, investing is not just about shares. Although I spend most of my time talking about shares.
Okay, so as an investor, then going from 98. You've moved on. You're far more educated now. You're spending far more time researching stocks, which is a new question I'm going to be asking a bit later on.
Okay.
Would you class yourself now, having moved away from where you initially was a value investor? What word would you use to describe yourself now as an investor with your own personal portfolio and wealth?
If you ask me what I want to own above all else, I want to own quality companies.
Yeah.
And for me, investing is quite simple, but it's not easy. To me, you're looking for companies. It's about interest rates. Everything's about an interest rate. I'll simplify it down to that. So I'm looking for companies that can earn a high interest rate on the money that they invest in their business in terms of the profits and the cash flows they get back.
So return on capital invested, yeah?
Return on capital invested. And also one of the things I look at as well is something called is free cash flow return on capital invested.
Right, okay.
And I probably pay more attention to free cash flow return on capital invested than return on capital invested, which is profit-based.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you there for 1 second. I don't like interrupting, Phil, but can you just expand on free cash flow for me, capital?
Yeah. So basically, if we start with the capital bit first.
Yeah.
In the best way to understand capital, I always try and explain it like a house. So like a house with a mortgage.
Yep.
So you can work out the amount of money you've invested by actually looking at the price you paid for the asset, your house price, or what you used to finance it with, a mortgage and new savings. And those two numbers will be the same. And companies are no different. So basically, the easiest way to work out how much money a company's invested, in very, very simple terms, is to look at the amount of shareholders' equity that it's got. So that's the amount of money that the shareholders have put into the business, plus all the profits that have been retained in the business. And then you add to that the value of borrowings, and that's going to get you fairly close to how much money a company has invested in its assets to make. And then you look at what you're getting back in return. So the thing about profits is that profits are an accounting term, and they're based on opinion rather than fact. And there are things that companies can do and clever accountants can do with a little stroke of the pen here, a little bit of massaging here, to make the profits of a company higher than they really are. And the thing about cash flow is that cash flow is a lot harder to manipulate. It is, you see it, whereas you actually don't really see a profit until it's actually being turned into cash. So I spend a lot of time, looking at how, the cash coming into the company. And then what you do is you take the cash coming in, so that's like the cash flow from its trading activities.
Yeah.
You take away, then you take away all the things that the company has to pay before it can give any money to shareholders.
Right.
So they have to pay tax. And then they also have to, if they've got lots of assets, they have to make sure that they keep them in a good state of repair, otherwise the business falls to bits.
Indeed, yeah.
So you take away the tax and you take away the spending on assets, which is known as capital expenditure. And then if you're looking at the money for shareholders, you take away any interest that they pay on borrowed money.
Yeah, debt.
And then what you've got left is what we call free cash flow. And so I spend a lot of time, looking for companies that can produce significant amounts of free cash flow, because I know that the profits are real.
Are real, yeah.
And if you look at particularly smaller companies, and we've had quite a few classic examples of this on the AIM market, where you've got companies that you think are making a lot of profits, and you look at the cash flow, and there's no cash flow, there's no free cash flow, and an investor could have saved themselves a lot of heartache by looking at cash flow rather than profits.
Yeah. I think the difficulty is, though, there's still a lot of investors who find it difficult to actually, or have the time or the inclination to actually read through the full RNS. And I've been at fault for that on a couple of occasions, even recently. You read the first two or three paragraphs and you go, right, okay, that reads good. And you're waiting for the share price to move. And then it's like, I don't quite understand why the share price has gone down. And it's buried down there, a couple of lines further down, the three or four pages of information that actually this is wrong with the company. And like you say, the cash flow has changed. The plans that they had regarding that part of the segment of the company has been hit by FX or something like that. So they don't really read the full RNS, or they don't really read the full report that comes out and the full year stats. So unless there's something that actually stands out in bold that says this is the cash flow or this is the true profits, people don't actually read it.
I think we're all guilty of that from time to time. I think there's, but I think also you've got to bear in mind that a lot of companies will
want to hide it.
yeah. I mean, they'll accentuate the positive,
yeah,
as much as they can, and then. Perhaps not talk as much about the bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best lessons, I think, that does a little bit of time spent reading is just so valuable when it comes to investing. And these statements, these RNS statements that come out, I mean, everyone can get them.
Yeah,
and everybody gets them at the same time, and. They contain, along with company annual reports, they contain a wealth of information. But I wrote a piece quite recently actually about this, and one of the best ways to try and find stuff is to actually get these RNS statements, print them off, and then start at the back. Right? Don't read any of the stuff that the management are talking about.
Yeah.
Go and look at the numbers. Get your calculator out and work out yourself, what the change, what the turnover's done, what the profit's done, what's the cash flow, what's happened to the debt.
Yeah.
Look at what's been going on in various bits of the business. Build up your own picture and then go and read what the management say and see if you agree.
Yeah, that's great advice, yeah.
And quite often there can be differences, particularly less so at the big companies, because the big companies are so heavily scrutinized.
And they've got more analysts watching them and checking them and questioning them as well, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. It's very difficult, but you know, unfortunately, you know, the smaller end of the market has got a little bit of a disappointing reputation when it comes to things like this.
Yeah. Okay, I'm really appreciate you covering the capital cash flow a bit and the importance of reading an RNS and full results properly. At some point, I would like to get that piece of research or the last article that you wrote shared with our listeners and readers if possible. I wanted to talk about your portfolio as it stands at the moment, Phil, and then I wanted to just break off a little bit and talk about SharePad and ShareScope. If you look at your investment portfolio now as 100%, where does that sit regarding the FTSE 100 stocks, funds, ETFs, etc.? How's it broken down?
Very quick answer to this.
Yeah,
virtually zero.
Right.
Up until probably about 3 or 4 days ago, I was 100% invested.
Right.
And I've taken the decision to take quite a lot of money off the table in the last few days.
Okay.
The rally in the stock market. Has pushed the valuation of a lot of the shares that I owned in my portfolio to sort of quite high levels.
You're right, okay.
If you're considering that I was investing a lot of my portfolio in quite high quality companies.
Yeah.
Overseas earners, big sort of consumer branded companies. In the last 2 weeks, the valuation of those companies has absolutely soared.
Right. Okay. Do you want to give any examples of the ones you've sold out of and the valuations? Why you think they're at extremes, Phil?
I mean, for example, I'll give you an example of a share. I mean, please. Obviously, just the caveat here. We're not obviously giving any investment.
No, we're not. Don't name the company then. Just give the valuation. You had it at the PE and what it is at now and why that was too much and you thought, well, it's time to go.
Okay. I mean, if we just go back a little bit, you know, one of the things I said a few minutes ago is that one of the things that I learned is that when you buy high quality shares, you have to be prepared to pay up for them, and it's a question of how much is too much. And you know, I've owned a share of a particular company for quite some time, and one of the things I look at for certain hours is something called the cash flow yield.
Right.
So, and I'm looking at an interest rate. So, I may have owned this share from maybe like a 6% cash flow yield. So that's the free cash flow per share divided by the share price.
Yeah.
And that cash flow yield has gone to just over 3%. Over a period of time and gone down to a very low interest rate in the last couple of weeks. So if you just turn it around into numbers, obviously some of your listeners might be better understanding it in numbers. It's gone from a price to cash free cash flow or a cash based PE ratio from just under 20 times to nearly 30 times.
Right, I'm with you, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And if you turn that upside down and divide 1 divided by 30, you get the interest rate.
Yeah.
So you can look at it either in a numbers-based way or an interest rate-based way. And for me, that's just got to be too much.
Yeah, so you think it's overstretched at the moment, you're going to wait for when it returns to a decent value.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, you know, as I said, I'm a very cautious investor. You know, I'm managing my own pension fund, and you know, one day I hope to be able to retire like all of us do.
Yeah.
The thing that going back to this is going back to this whole theme of risk, and you know. If a company that you own or a chunk of your portfolio goes down by a large amount, it has to go up by an even bigger amount just to get back to where you were.
Yeah.
So you know, when you see a situation where, you know, my portfolio, I think I've probably made first 6 months of this year, I've probably made about 12-13%, which I'm quite pleased with. I just wanted to lock some of that in.
Yeah.
And the other thing as well is that a lot of these companies that I've been owning for a while and that have served me quite well, the actual underlying rate of growth of profits and cash flows has actually been quite modest.
Yeah.
And what's been happening in the environment that we've been in is that investors have flocked to these kind of shares as almost like a safe haven, because they believe that the products that they're selling are so robust that these have got to be a safe place to invest. And as the interest rates keep coming down and down, people sort of struggle, where am I going to put my money? And these kind of shares have been a big beneficiary of that kind of trend. And they might go even higher. But I've just become a little bit worried about the pricing of some of these shares.
No, I understand that. I mean, the consumer cyclicals and farmers and so on and so forth. And indeed, the tobacco companies have had a stellar sort of run for nearly 20 odd years now for those very reasons, haven't they? Because, there's very little competition for them.
Absolutely. And they've been fantastic cash flow generators and they've paid out very large dividends to their shareholders. But if you look at just some of these companies, I mean, I'll name a company that I haven't owned.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
And it's interesting, quite an interesting one. I look at a lot of American shares as well, and Procter and Gamble, would have been seen as one of the almost like a must own. You look at some of the brands it's got, like Gillette and things like that, and you think, yeah. Look at all these are all the things that I can find in my cupboard or in my bathroom. It's got to be a great business.
Yeah.
And the business isn't growing. Yet you look at the valuation that Wall Street attaches to these companies. And, 23, 24, 25 times earnings. And that might continue, that trend might continue to go higher. But I think one of the lessons that you learn as an investor is that valuations can stay stretched for a long time, but so when something changes, usually profits, you have a profit disappointment, a profit warning, or a profit slowdown. These companies can change in value at absolutely frightening speeds, and therefore the risk as an investor from owning highly priced shares gets bigger and bigger and bigger the higher the valuation goes. So, it's again, I'm sounding a bit repetitive and maybe a bit boring on this.
No.
But it's like it's the risk is as important as the reward.
Yeah.
There are two forms of risk. The first risk and the most important one is buying the wrong business in the first place. And then secondly, it's about paying the wrong price for it. And the biggest risk that investors have is paying the right price. The problem is that you'll never get out at the top or in at the bottom.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's something that if you are, quite a risk-averse investor, and you're saving for your future, and you think, okay, I've had a bit of a good run here, and I'm just gonna bank some profit.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with taking a bit of profit, mate. I mean, I've just put up here in front of me the stats that you mentioned for Procter & Gamble. Now, for hardly any growth or no growth, the PE that I'm seeing on the screen that I've got in front of me is 28. Now, that's a racy sort of PE for a stock that's not, a company that's not growing profits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've seen a lot of other companies as well. I mean, another one. Again, I've not owned this, but
Johnson & Johnson hit records last week, I think, as well, didn't it? All-time records, another one.
Now, who knows? One of the things I have learned is that never ever think you're right, or tell anybody else you think you're right. but what you're trying to do is you're trying to balance it, aren't you? You're trying to balance your odds, and we could have a situation where. We have negative interest rates, you know, where we've got negative interest rates in a lot of parts of the world already.
We have, yeah. NERPA's, we've definitely got those, and they're coming our way by the looks of it.
It looks that way, yeah. And so if people are, you know, I can understand, you know, completely why investors who look around and say, well, I'm getting nothing in the bank and the savings, I'm getting nothing in bonds, but I've got, you know, there are some very high quality companies out there that might give me 3 or 4%.
Yeah, indeed. And then they get, and then you're in the market then, aren't you? You know, you invariably get pushed into equities because properties now, you know, all the people that are putting money into London, properties and all the rest of it are now considering that move now. And we'll see the effects of that over the next 6 to 12 months. And then they'll think, you know what, London's had its day. Let's go and look up north, you know, back up to Sheffield or Manchester or Glasgow or Edinburgh. And then after that, it's like, oh, well, there's nowhere to go now. They'll do the full circle and go back into equities looking for value. So
well, I think
it's cyclical,
I think you raise a really interesting point there because I think, you know, if you look at the stock market at the moment, certainly, you know, what's happened in the last couple of weeks, you realise that you've got two or maybe even several different types of stock market running at the same time. You know, you look at some of the valuations now of some of these UK earnings shares, and they are battered down now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how that develops, because I'm sure there'll be some fund managers out there who think, okay, you know, you've got these big multi-cap, mega-cap multinationals trading on high valuations, and you've got, you know, domestic UK earners trading on single-digit. And I think I did a screen this morning, actually, looking at the FTSE All Share and looking at how many shares had a dividend yield more than their PE. And I forget how many there were, but there were a lot. And it's, you know, it's things like that where people sometimes look back in hindsight and think, oh, I wish I'd had a few of them.
Yeah, it is, and there's quite a few. I mean, obviously, you've got the builders. But what I was going to touch on with regarding what you've just said about the stuff going on at this present time is that what I'm always looking at the fund managers, because obviously, as we've touched on before, is that they make their money with regards to what they have as asset under management. Now, you've got some staggering companies out there. I won't name names now, but you've got some staggering companies out there that have got so much money under management, but yet the PE ratios at the present time are 6, 7, 8. You know, and it's like, well, there's going to have to be some consolidation at some point, or these companies that have got their monies in dollars is thinking, you know what, I'm getting 20%, 15%, 12% more for my bang for my buck. I'll go and buy that company in the UK now because it's on the cheap.
Yeah, I think, you know, and it wouldn't surprise me if some companies, you know, became that sort of theme actually came to be played out.
Yeah.
You know, American businesses with lots of firepower, and also you have to bear in mind that you know, these companies now can borrow for next to nothing.
Indeed, and which is what they've been doing as well for the last 2 years, haven't they?
Absolutely, yeah. So whether, you know, the other thing as well is that it's actually quite hard to get some growth out there as well. And one of the ways that companies can grow is by buying other companies.
Yeah, acquisition. Yeah, definitely.
So that might happen.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to touch on a question that's been posed to me just this morning, actually, by somebody that listened to another podcast, and it's not something I've incorporated before in the questions. I'm just adding it today. We've touched on it and touched on it already, but I just wanted to get some sort of dynamic from you. Previously, as an investor, and now a second phase of you doing your work with ShareScope for SharePad, how much time, Phil, do you spend researching stocks, daily or weekly, whichever answer you want to give?
During the daily and weekly, not a lot, because obviously I've got a job to do.
Yeah.
So if you look at how when I used to do it, I would spend probably, I don't know, to come to a decision on a share. I mean, it's quite a few hours.
Yeah.
Maybe go into days. You know, you would read. I spend a lot of time reading annual reports, and you know, before I had something like SharePad, I would like download. I would get 10 years annual reports off the internet and shove a load of numbers into a spreadsheet,
right?
And that might take me days to do that. And then what I would do is that I would then, you know, read the last year's annual report.
Yeah.
And then I would look at periods of time in the last 10 years where there'd been a significant change in profits. So, you know, for example, I spend a lot of time looking at how companies have gone through things like recessions in the past.
Yeah, I've coped, yeah.
And you go and read what the management said and you understand, you know, how the bad stuff can happen. But in answer to your question, a lot of time, these days I will spend a lot less doing it because I've got a bit of software that does a lot of the number crunching for me, which I work with all the time.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Now, thank you for answering that question. We're going to move straight on to ShareScope and SharePad now. Brilliant piece of software, as you've said. It's been endorsed by lots and lots of people, won awards here, there, and everywhere. And it's something, as a filter and a screening process, is absolutely wonderful. And it cuts down on that time, which invariably people have got time restraints regarding their own personal commitments and work commitments. Do you want to tell me a bit more about ShareScope and ShearPad now, Phil, please?
Yeah. ShareScope's sort of the sort of flagship product for the company for a long time. It's been around for a long time. And it's been around since 1997. And Martin Stamp, he's the owner of the company. He's a Cambridge mathematician and computer programmer. And he, in a previous life, you know, he did very well out of working for a software company. And probably about 20 years ago, he spent a lot of time trying to work out how to sift through the stock market. He was looking for products to help him do it, and he couldn't find any, so he built one.
Brilliant.
And he started from scratch. I think he hired one other programmer, and that is how ShareScope started. And you know, over the years, ShareScope developed, it added more and more features and more tools for private investors, like portfolio tools, and it worked out people's tax calculations and all that kind of thing, and built up a big following amongst private investors.
Yeah, done exceptionally well with it.
And you know, the company now, if you look at the company now, there's probably around 20 employees, and we've got, you know, eight people working in software doing all the programming and the data. And And we've got five people who work customer service on the phone. And, you know, that's one of the things I, you know, actually like about the company, is that I do like to think that, you know, we put a lot of time and thought about listening to our customers and trying to help them, really.
Yeah, and I've noticed that you keep enhancing and changing and improving and refining all the time. And that's maybe why ShearPad was developed as well, because that's like the daughter of, or the son of, ShareScope's initial software, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, in all honesty, you know, this is a product that the company had to develop. ShareScope is a program that is basically gets loaded onto a Windows PC.
Yeah,
and it's got a lot of advantages, you know, particularly for people who do a lot of technical analysis and looking at charts.
Yep.
The speed you get of navigating on something that's downloaded onto your hard drive is great, but as we all know, the world is changing, and yeah, people look at things through browsers now.
Yeah, and the phone. Yeah,
yeah. So, but not only that, it's from a programming point of view and product development point of view, it's a lot easier and straightforward to develop new features in ShearPad,
right? Okay.
Than it is in ShareScope. If we want to make a little change to ShareScope, you have to do a complete new release of the software.
Oh.
Whereas if we want to make an addition to SharePad, a new feature, we can literally add it overnight.
Oh, I see.
And some of the things that we're doing with SharePad, you know, in terms of filtering the charts that we've got, some of the evaluation tools that we've put in there, it's just a lot easier to develop, but it's also a lot easier for the user to get to grips with it.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, with regards to SharePad, you've been to a couple of, well, I've seen it at a couple of shows, people are using it as we're talking, you go to shows and people are actually there on their phones using SharePad to screen the company that they're sitting in front of listening to. And that's what I love about it. It's so easy to use.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, we keep trying to make it easier. And I think that that's the whole reason that why we have the product, really, because we get back to this thing, and the question you've just asked me about how much time do you spend researching things. A lot of us are all very busy people.
Yeah.
And we've got more and more people who are interested in the stock market, but they haven't got the time to spend hours and hours and hours, or lots of people have it. I know there are people who do it full time. And it's about trying to make it simpler and easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, we've got a lot more things coming as well that hopefully keep on doing that.
Excellent, excellent. Now, at some point in the future, LSE Share Talk will be doing some events, Phil. So I'd love to have you and the ShareScope team potentially come and give a little talk as well regarding some of the software that you've got coming up and about SharePad and ShareScope, if that's possible.
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I'm going to go back now to your journey, if I may.
Yeah.
I want you to touch on what has been the greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing in 1998.
That's a good question. I think if I was to say anything, it is read a lot.
Okay.
Keep trying to learn stuff, because you're learning all the time. And I think, just as a sort of side shot to that, is you need to try and be aware of what you don't know, rather than what you do know. Mm-hmm. Because I think if you focus on what you do know, there's a tendency for you to become overconfident.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think, one of the things that one of the directors at my first firm said to me nearly 20 years ago is that you need a lot of humility to be an investor.
Absolutely.
And I think he was dead right.
And it's a spot on. I think unfortunately, and you see it on Twitter sometimes, there's just far too many egos out there. And I've interviewed a wonderful lady called Catherine Stott, who's written a brilliant book called Hypnotrading. And that is one of the major downfall of success, is ego and lack of humility, and having a vibe that you know it all. And I'm a big follower and I'm a practitioner of NLP. And there's a saying that we have that you don't know what you don't know that you don't know, and you always got to learn something.
Absolutely, yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Okay, so what has been your wisest investment decision to date, Phil?
Ooh.
Other than marrying your wife, who's a doctor, who's looking after
course.
You.
Of course, that's my best investment.
Get that in there in case she's listening.
Yeah. Oh no, she won't want to listen to me rambling. But I don't know. I mean, you mean in terms of?
It could be personal, or it could be regarding a successful trade you did. But I prefer personal, because it's about your journey, really.
Yeah, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say it was any sort of particular share. I mean, there's a few shares that I've bought and been lucky with, but I think if it's going to sound a bit boring, this, but
go for it.
One of the things that I learned to do before I started investing money in the stock market was to do one of the most simple things that a lot of people don't do. And I think one of the best investments I've ever made was to pay down my mortgage.
Yep.
And, you know, to try and give yourself a bit of a buffer, and so that you actually, I think, to me, it just seems ridiculous when you've got people saying, oh, they've built up these portfolios, yet they've still got, you know, a big mortgage and big debt. So
never understood that myself.
Yeah. So if just sort of paying that down. I mean, that's one of the most sort of tax efficient investments that you can make. I know people have changed their view on that when because interest rates have come down. But you know, there's still a decent saving there, and you never know in the future. Interest rates might go up,
and
if you have paid down a chunk of your mortgage, you're not gonna have as nasty a surprise as you might have done.
Indeed, I agree with that. I mean, there is this thing I have, a big thing about having financial freedom to do what I want. And I don't believe that the richest people in the world are the richest people in the world. It's about how much financial freedom they've got to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it. And not everybody's got that freedom, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of my other sort of interests as well. Apart from sort of share, I'm quite interested in, you know, personal finance, and I've got the qualifications to be a financial advisor, but it's not something that I'd want to do for full time. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that I'm sort of an old fashioned attitudes to savings and things like that, and sort of living beneath your means and focusing on proper stuff rather than material stuff and that kind of thing.
Now, I mean, I've spoken to somebody else that's from up north, and I know that I've got so many people listening from all over the world, and I have to just throw that in. It's a very northern thing, that sort of thinking, isn't it? You know, live within your means. You've got a pound, you know, or five bob, as we used to call it up there, and you don't spend that. You only spend half of it, you know, because you never know what's going to be happening. Rainy day money, as such.
Absolutely, I think you have to enjoy yourself as well. I do know some of my friends from back home who take it to the point of meanness. Not beyond. there's no point in doing that.
No, there's frugal and there's meanness, definitely.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, Phil, other than the ones you've already mentioned, which one would you like to share with our audience that you've not touched on yet? One of the many lessons that you've learned.
I think that one of the biggest lessons is don't try and predict the future. Don't try and think that you know what's going to happen to something in 5, 10 years time, because the chances are you're going to be way off. And I think a lot of investors think they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what you do learn very quickly is that human beings are really, really bad at predicting the future. And which is why actually investing is actually so difficult.
And also
why so many people can trip up, because they get overconfident. You see it every day in the city a lot. You know how, you know, a lot of analysts' forecasts and price targets are based on something that's been shoved into a spreadsheet on what the company might earn in 10, 15 years' time. And that's taken as almost cast iron certainty will happen.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work out that way.
Absolutely.
What is better, instead of trying to predict the future and accepting that you can't predict the future, what you can do is that, you know, I've always said, you know, what are the two best tools that any investor has got? And it's the current rate of profits of the company, current level of profits, and the share price. And I'm not going to get into it now. I mean, I've written about this, but you can work out, you know, how much of the current share price is explained by the current level of profits there are ways that you can do that. I wouldn't want to go into it and bore people and do it. I've written articles on our website which people can read about this.
Okie dokie.
But you can do that, and you can find, you know, for example, I'll give you an example now. You've got certain shares in the FTSE 250 where if you looked at their current profits and you thought they could continue at exactly the same level forever, then the shares are undervalued. So what you've then got to do as an investor is work out whether those profits are going to go down, stay the same, or go up. And it's not a question of how much, it's just the direction of change. You know, for example, like house builders, for example, very topical example of this. Share prices have been hammered and the valuations on these companies look very cheap. But you know from studying history that the profits of these companies do tend to go through phases of ups and downs.
Yeah, very cyclical.
And you've got to try and work out where you are in the cycle and where profits are likely to go. So that is a much better use of your time than trying to predict what the profit forecast will be in 2018 or 2019. And that is how you can, make some quite good investment decisions and identify cheap and expensive shares.
No, that's great, great, great advice there. Thank you very much for that, mate. I wanted to ask another question there. If there was one thing that you could change regarding the investing landscape as it is now, what would that be, Phil?
This is a big, big sort of bugbear of mine. I would like to see a lot more, not regulation, but a lot more stringent tests put on companies buying back their own shares. I think we've seen a lot of companies do share buybacks rather than paying dividends to shareholders. And in quite a lot of these circumstances, the buyback of shares, which is done to increase profit per share or earnings per share,
yeah, indeed,
hasn't actually made the shareholder any richer. It's made the management richer.
Yeah.
Because they've shrunk the number of shares and the earnings per share's gone up.
Yeah, and they've met their targets for their options that way, haven't they?
Exactly. Which get issued at the shareholders' expense.
Indeed.
But it actually hasn't made the shareholder any richer, because if the share price doesn't go up, you only get richer as a shareholder if the share price goes up or you get a bigger dividend. How you make money. Now, I would have liked to have seen a lot more money that's been used for share buybacks to have been paid as special dividends, because the great thing about investing in shares, and this is why dividends are important, because once someone's paid you a dividend, it can't be taken away.
Yeah.
But as you know, if a share price goes up 20%, it can go down 20% as well. And unless you take advantage and sell and pocket your profit, you've made no money. But if you get paid a dividend and that goes into your stockbroking account or into your bank account, that's money that can't be taken away from you. And it's a vital part of the total return you get from owning a share.
Yeah.
And I think share buybacks have been abused, terribly abused by lots of companies, and have not done shareholders any favours at all. So I'd like to see one of the best companies that actually used share buybacks in a good way is Next.
Yeah.
Next actually has a special test, and it explains to shareholders in its annual report what price is good for buying back shares and why. And it says it won't do it above a certain price, and it explains very nicely to the shareholder why it won't do that.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you. Why don't other companies do this test then?
Because it's just so easy to enhance earnings per share.
Yeah.
You know, if you're borrowing money at next to nothing, you shrink the number of shares and you don't shrink your profit that much because there's less shares
available. Yeah.
Yeah, because the interest on the money you might borrow to do that is tiny.
Yeah.
We've actually put a tool on the SharePoint website to help investors work this out, actually.
Okay, excellent.
So when a company buys back shares, they put the share price in, they put the amount of money being spent on the share price, and it gives an equivalent return on investment that buying those shares would give the investor,
yeah.
which is completely copied from the next example. But we think that's quite an interesting thing to help shareholders work out if that's a good or a bad thing. And in most cases, unfortunately, it's a bad thing.
Okay, right. I'm going to go back just slightly because we've touched on two points there, which reiterate what you've just said earlier about human beings really, really bad at predicting things. Now, I can't go through this interview without touching on the EU ref and the mess that we're in now, and the human calculation of risk, fear, hate, rhetoric, reality versus what's actually going on the ground floor. And we're left in a situation where we've got X amount of parties, you know, bar the Lib Dems at the minute, that have got no leaders essentially because Cameron's on holiday already. And we've got a situation where the people who voted to leave don't appear to be getting whatever they wanted or thought they were going to get. And the people who voted, the 48% that actually went out to vote, that voted to remain, may not get what they want in a sense of we want a second referendum and we want, you know, this being done and that being done. We're in a bit of a mess. So what are we to make of the situation, given the fact that no one's predicted what this outcome would lead to, whereby we've lost Cameron, essentially, we've lost Boris, we've lost Gove, we're in the verge of losing Corbyn for all different reasons. Your thoughts, Phil? Anything? Personal viewpoint, actually, not from ShareScope?
Yeah. Well, I think if anything has shown you that, you know, human beings are lousy predictors, then I think the EU referendum is a great example of that.
Yeah.
You know, I went to bed at 12 o'clock on the Thursday of the referendum, and a pound bought $1.50.
I saw that $1.50. I was up until the Newcastle result, then I saw the Sunderland result, and I was like, I'm off to bed now. Can't take any more of this.
Yeah, I went to bed and sort of woke up again about 3 o'clock, and I thought, oh, I'll go downstairs and see what's going on. And, you know, completely different. And the pound bought $1.37 or something.
Yeah, it went sub 130 yesterday, I think.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I don't know why. I mean, you know, you'll get people who are saying like, it was game, you know, people in the city got it wrong and the gamblers got it wrong. And, but yeah, it shows, you know, if you look at, you know, some of the predictions that are made about what would happen to interest rates as well, you know, interest rates have gone down. You know, not they haven't. I mean, a lot of people thought that the pound would go down, and it has gone down.
Yep. Soros betted big, didn't he, on that?
And then the Bank of England actually would have to raise interest rates to defend the value of the pound by making it more attractive for people to hold pounds.
Well, that doesn't look like it's going to happen now, given what Carney's been saying the last couple of times.
Absolutely
it's popped
not. Up. You know, it's not. It's, you know, you're talking about, you know, they reckon that base rates will be 0.25% next week. Some people are saying there'll be more money printing, and that's just going to drive the pound down further.
Even further, yeah. But part of me thinks, Phil, and this is just my personal viewpoint, and I do a lot of research, and invariably I try to look at and unpick other people's research. But there is an argument to say that, you know, given the state of play in the UK with our lack of growth, and it has been a case of lack of growth industry-wise, service-wise for a good few years now, that in order to sell our services and products, we actually need a lower sterling. So invariably, it's almost like this is playing into the hands of the power brokers that actually need things to be cheaper to be bought by the US or by the Chinese or by the Japanese.
Obviously, there's two sides to it. I think, you know, if you're an exporter, you're really happy what's happened to the value of the pound.
Yeah.
If you're an importer,
which we invariably as a country are,
you know, it'd be, you know, it is. Going to raise prices, and you know, the chances are that we'll all be paying more for our potentially paying more for our food, more for our petrol, more money to go on foreign holidays. I think
that's already started. Yeah,
probably true.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's all many things going on at once. I mean, I was reading the other day that food prices are still coming down, and it'll take some time for this exchange rate to come through. And the one thing we don't know is, you know, how long will the exchange rate stay this way? What we don't know, again, is, you know, in 2 or 3 months' time, whoever the prime minister is might go to the EU and all this gets sorted out.
Yeah.
And the uncertainty disappears and the pound is back at 150 again.
That could happen. I mean, I don't see it going back to 150 in any hurry. And it's a bit bizarre that we've got Theresa May, who's likely to win. I'm not predicting, by the way, is likely to win. And she voted, she was in the Leave campaign, in the Remain campaign. It's just madness.
Yeah, it creates a lot of uncertainty, and people don't like uncertainty. I do think, though, you know, despite quite often seeing the dark side of things, and I think that eventually this will all sort out, because everybody needs it to sort out.
Yeah,
you know, if you're a BMW. If you're BMW, you know that the price of your BMW cars have gone up 10% in a fortnight.
Yeah.
And you want to do something about that. You know, the last thing you want to do is shove a tariff on that as well.
Yeah.
You've had a devaluation of the pound against the euro, you know, roughly 10% there or thereabouts. Why would you want to then throw tariffs on British goods and see tariffs put on yours? The answer is that you don't. But we're dealing with politicians here, and you can't sort of predict what these people will do.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. No, thanks for that. I've got two more questions, Phil.
Yeah.
And then it's anything you want to talk about. I'm conscious that we've had you on here for a little while now. If you were starting out today in investing, what would you do that you'd not considered or were unable to do back in 1998?
I think what I'd do is I'd do a lot more sort of test and dummy portfolios. I would try and practice a lot more with and sort of like a what I would call a test fictional type portfolio, and set it up and as if I was owning it, and see how I could cope with the day-to-day movements and news flows over time, to see how to understand my investing temperament. I think because one of the things that it's very difficult as a young investor or a beginning investor starting out is that you don't really know how are you going to be able to cope with things that happen, things that get thrown at you, rather like a, you know, either a share price change or a profit change or an acquisition or that kind of thing. And that's the sort of thing that takes time. And I know it's probably not, you know, most people's inclination is to jump in straight away. And I know I said right at the beginning of this, there's nothing that focuses your mind more than owning a share. But I think sometimes if you're a beginning investor, particularly, take some sort of time to do like a trial run, a dummy run, and spend some time going through processes of what actually having a portfolio of shares would be. And I think that's, to me, I think that would be invaluable.
No, I appreciate that reply, and I think it is something that needs to be done more and more so now, because the speed of the market and the volatility of the market and high frequency trading invariably means that those people that haven't practiced and haven't taken the time to do a bit more reading and trial run it or dummy run it, as you say, they jump in and they jump out. And you know, I think we had a big swing, was it last August, September, in the markets? Lots of those people haven't come back to the market, you know, and we had the same in 2007 and 2008. There's lots of people I know from the dot-com era never came back to the market. So, you know, I think with a little bit of patience and position sizing, people can stay in the market a bit longer if they take the time to learn about investing and trading.
I think what's good actually is that I don't know what your experience is, but I've seen, you know, there's a few broken websites and where they do actually let you set up dummy accounts, particularly for spread betting and trading accounts. I've seen that on a couple of stockbroking type accounts or spread betting accounts.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah, I agree. There's a few like that are doing that now, and invariably they're trying to entice you eventually to open the account and, you know, trade for real. But at least if you want to take up that opportunity, it's there for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, or you almost think, you know, that's almost like a duty of care on their behalf.
Yes,
well.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. Right. I've got two more questions, and this one here is a more recent question. What in your viewpoint, your personal viewpoint, Phil, and you can't say ShareScope or SharePad, what is the best kept secret to investing or trading? Because I knew you'd say ShareScope or ShareFide, you see. That's why I said that.
Conker's Corner.
Oh, that's very, very kind of you, mate. Cuts. You don't need to add any more to that. That's fine.
I've actually really enjoyed listening to a lot of the interviews that you've done.
Thank you.
What was the question again? The biggest secret?
No, the best kept secret.
The best kept secret.
Or trading.
For investment, I have to say I'm not really an expert on trading.
Okay.
Investing, the best kept secret. Is it a secret? I don't know if it's a secret, but I think the best kind of thing about investing is the power of compound interest.
That keeps getting repeated. Yeah, that's brilliant.
It's not a secret. Mm-hmm. But I think if you ask a lot of people who invest, they probably wouldn't think, quite a few of them probably wouldn't think about it. But the thing about compound interest is that I think it's actually changed how you actually exploit the sort of snowball effect. I think the way that investors get the benefit of that has changed. And I think if you read a lot of the textbooks, it kind of comes across as, you know, you own one share and you own it for 30 years and you reinvest your dividends and you end up with a large sum of money. That can happen.
Yeah.
But I think that the stock market and the economy and the backdrop are, I think we live in quite interesting times, different times. And, you know, if you look at how the stock market has changed and almost like for the last 15 years has almost traded in a range.
Certainly
the FTSE 100 has. Mm-hmm,
yeah.
So I think what investors have to do is potentially be, I think, you know, a lot of people said, buy and hold is dead. Well, I don't know. For some companies, no doubt buy and hold will still work.
Yeah.
But perhaps you have to be a lot more nimble and switch between different shares more often than perhaps you thought you might have to do to get the benefit of compound interest.
No, I agree with that, mate. And that's a reply that I've been given a few times, as you know, having listened to the other podcasts. And unfortunately, it's something that some people are coming to belatedly. And there's a reason why, touching on what you said earlier, that those quality companies that are still there, still doing the business and they're paying a yield, more and more of them are getting bought by the same people, by the same fund managers. And hence the reason why the PE ratios on some of those have gone up, you know, and have become overstretched.
It's like the Nifty 50.
Nifty 50, yeah.
Back in the 1970s, almost.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I've got one other question, Phil, and this is just about your learning and your appreciation of books, which I absolutely adore as well. And I've had to compromise with. I've not got half of my books with me at the minute because they're still in storage, having moved recently. But having done what you've done and read so many books, could you, to our global audience, just recommend some of the books that you would not be without and have really changed your thinking regarding investing?
Yeah, happy to do that. I think one of the best books, and it's written really simple book, beautifully written, can be read in about an hour, is The Little Book That Beats the Market by Joel Greenblatt.
Yeah.
That is a really, really good book and gets a lot of what investing is about, and it's written beautifully, that know, the layperson can understand, hopefully, pretty easily. That's an extremely good book. A lot of books that get The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham is a book that gets mentioned a lot. What I would say about that book is that it's probably a little bit out of date now in the way that it explains the tools of analysis, the focuses on, you know, asset values and back and balance sheet values, and those kind of shares just don't exist, particularly in a market like this. But Warren Buffett, you know, this is not my idea, Warren Buffett always says, read chapter 8 and chapter 20 of that book, which is about how the investor copes with fluctuating stock prices. So it's about emotions,
yeah,
and how they can take advantage of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is the chapter 20, I think, is the one about this margin of safety. So, you know, try and work out what a company is worth, and then try and buy at a discount to value.
That's my philosophy. Yeah, definitely.
If you just read those two chapters rather than struggling through some of the stuff that's probably not going to be that useful to you, those two books.
I just wanted a couple, you know, because
those are the two I think for a private investor. A lot of the books that you can buy, they are quite heavy going. I mean, you know, I've read some of them and think, oh, this is, I don't really want to read too much in this. So I actually find myself when I buy books just almost fixating on maybe even a chapter or even less, where you take that and you think, right, okay, I'll stick that in my knowledge bank and use that. The other one as well, which is a very good book, still in print, is the Zulu Principle by Jim Slater.
Yeah, it's a big favourite with lots of UK investors, yeah.
And then another one, which I would, again, these are sort of aimed at easy reading, really, which I'm always a fan of, is a book called Accounts Demystified by Anthony Rice.
That's not one I'm familiar with. Go on, expand on that, please.
That's basically, that's a really well-written book. And the author does a great job of explaining a really dry subject like accounting in layman's terms, so that, you know, particularly a beginning investor can understand what's going on. And that's a really, really good book.
Okay, that's good. I'll make sure that people become aware of that one. Yeah. Okay.
I wrote an article on the ShareScope website, actually, about some of my favourite investing books. Where some of these are
listed.
These books are on there. Some of them are a bit more advanced, and some of them are a bit more suitable for the beginner or somebody who likes an easy read.
Okie dokie. Well, I spoke with Edmund Shing this week. He's the author of the Idle Investor book, a very small book, but absolutely brilliant on simple ideas to follow, thematic and also seasonal. And it's a really, really good book. So if you haven't read that yet, I'd recommend that one for you.
I'll make a note of that, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll be publishing his podcast in a little while. Now, Phil, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I've finished all my questions. I didn't know if there's anything you wanted to add that I've not covered that you wanted to share to enhance our audience's learning.
I don't think so, Peter. I think, you know, I think people have probably got sick of listening.
I'm sure that's not the case. Okay then, mate. We'll close it there. I want to say thank you ever so much for coming on and talking about ShareScope and SharePad. I'll be putting a link on the publication back to the site so people can see all the different things that you've got, and you know, share the information regarding SharePad as much as you can. And I look forward to LSE Share Talk and myself working with you in the future, mate.
Thanks very much, Peter.
All right. Take care. God bless, mate.
Cheers. Thanks.
Bye.